Let me know in the chat if you can't hear me, but I have a few people say okay. 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 Well, the topic for tonight is Lincoln, the Hamiltonian Mercantilist. And we left off last week. You might remember we talked about Lincoln's first inaugural address, where he bent over backwards and to defend Southern slavery. He said in his first inaugural address that I had no intention to disturb Southern slavery, and if I did, it would be unconstitutional to do so. You can read all my past speeches. I support the Republican Party platform, which protects Southern slavery. He said he endorses the Fugitive Slave Act. It was the strongest support of Southern slavery ever made by an American politician. But at the same time, he literally threatened war over tariff collection, literally, in plain language of the first inaugural address. And at the time, the only dispute over slavery was the extension of slavery into the new territories, as I mentioned. And I want to read a few more things to you from some original sources. about Southern slavery. And this, the first one is, there was the famous Wilmot Proviso, which was introduced in Congress originally in 1846, that would have barred slavery from the new territories. It never became, that particular proviso never became law. But there's a historian named Michael Holt, H-O-L-T, who teaches at the University of Virginia. He's been there for many, many years. He's the big expert on antebellum politics in America. He wrote a gigantic book called On the History of the Whig Party, which, if you're interested in this sort of thing, it's the reference on the Whig Party. And he also wrote a smaller book on his opinions of the causes and consequences of the American Civil War. And he points out in his book that David Wilmot, Congressman David Wilmot himself, called his proviso the white man's proviso. And he said this, and the main reason was that the purpose of it was to keep black people out of the territory. It had nothing to do with gradual emancipation. Modern historians and other scholars have made up or fabricated the story that somehow the people who advocated banning the extension of slavery thought that this would be sort of a low-hanging fruit strategy that would lead to the eventual ending of slavery everywhere. They never explained just how this was supposed to work. And besides that, the people alive at the time did not say this. Modern historians just made this up. They don't quote anybody as saying that. But here's what a well-known historian named Eugene Berwanger said, and he wrote this in a book called The Frontier Against Slavery. He said this, quote, "Republicans made no pretense of being concerned with the fate of the Negro and insisted that theirs was a party of white labor. By introducing a note of white supremacy, they hoped to win the votes of the Negrophobes and the anti-abolitionists who were opposed to the extension of slavery." And so I think that is a perfect description of why the Republican Party of Lincoln opposed the extension of slavery. After all, it was only white men, adult white men, who could vote. Women could not vote at the time. Free blacks could not vote. Slaves certainly could not vote. And so they were pandering for votes. They wanted to be the party of free white labor. And that's keeping all blacks out of the territories, free or slave, was their position, was their way of doing that. Another quote by Michael Holt on this, in his little book, I'll give you the name of the book, The Fate of Their Country, by Michael Holt, which I would recommend. He's quite a good scholar. He says this on the same subject. Many northern whites also wanted to keep slaves out of the West in order to keep blacks out. The North was a pervasively racist society where free blacks suffered social, economic, and political discrimination. Being bigots, they sought to bar African American slaves from the West. That's Michael Holt saying that. And then on the question of why the Republicans were so concerned about blocking the blacks, free blacks or slaves from the new territories. It wasn't just racism or white supremacy, but politics. Michael Hope quotes an Ohio congressman named Joshua Giddings saying this, quote, "To give the South the preponderance of political power would be itself a surrender of our tariff, our internal improvements, our distribution of proceeds of public lands. It is the most abominable proposition which a free people were ever insulted," end quote. So let me interpret this. The party platform of the Republicans was the same as the Whig party platform: protectionist tariffs, a central bank run by politicians out of Washington, D.C., and massive corporate welfare for railroads, road building, and canal building companies. So when he says we would surrender our tariff, our internal improvements, and so forth, that's what he was talking about. And regarding public land, there was a dispute before the Civil War whereby the Democrats, mostly the Southern Democrats, wanted the government to sell the public land that it claimed ownership in, whereas the Republican Party wanted to give it away. And they eventually did under the Homestead Act. And the great majority of the land that was given away to corporations, railroad corporations, mining corporations, timber corporations. Far less than half of it was actually given to real settlers under the Homestead Act. And so that's what he was referring to there. And so these two things, the extension of slavery and the economic agenda, were linked, because if slaves were brought into the territories, then that would have increased the congressional representation of the Democratic Party because of the three-fifths clause of the Constitution. That's what Congressman Joshua Giddings is referring to. He's referring to the fact that if slaves were brought in there, it would increase the representation of the Democratic Party, and they would block this mercantilist economic agenda that the Whig Party failed to adopt in its 25 years existence, and it was now the mantle of the Republican Party. And so, and this was always the agenda of Abe Lincoln. Here's what Lincoln said himself when he first got into politics. I read this last week, actually, but I'm going to read it again. He said, "I presume you all know who I am. I am humble Abraham Lincoln." That's a lie there. "I have been solicited by many friends," another lie, "to become a candidate for the legislature. My politics are short and sweet, like the old woman's dance. I'm in favor of a national bank, in favor of the internal improvement system, and a high protective tariff." That's what Lincoln said was his motivation for getting into politics. That's what motivated him. That's why he became a politician. A while later, Senator John Sherman, who was very influential for decades in the Republican Party, at the time of the Civil War, he was the chairman of the United States Senate Finance Committee. So this was, he was a very, very powerful man within the Republican Party. During the Civil War, this is the same Senator John Sherman whose name is on the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. So he had a very long career. He was the brother of General William Tecumseh Sherman. He said this when he gave a speech explaining why the Republican Party nominated and then elected Lincoln as president. He said this, quote, "Those who elected Mr. Lincoln expected him to secure to free labor its just right to the territories of the United States. That is, ban black people, free or slave." Continuing on with the quote, "To protect by wise revenue laws the labor of our people, protectionist tariffs." Continuing on with the quote, "To secure the public lands to actual settlers," giving away the public land, not selling it, "and to develop the internal resources of the country by opening new means of communication between the Atlantic and Pacific." For that, he meant massive subsidies to the railroad corporations to build a transcontinental railroad. And so Abe Lincoln said in 1832 that the only reason he was getting into politics was that his politics were short and sweet. He's for a high protectionist tariff, a central bank, and corporate welfare. 30 years later, Senator John Sherman said the reason we elected Abe Lincoln was he would carry forth high protective tariff, Corporate Welfare Central Bank. That's what Alexander Hamilton labeled the American system, even though it was really the British mercantilist system, the American version of it. And so that's what he said he wanted when he was running for president. And he stuck with that for 30 years. And in Michael Holt's book on the history of the Whig Party, he mentions that he says that no one was a more vociferous proponent of resurrecting the National Bank than Abe Lincoln was. I think I might have Michael Holt's book handy here somewhere. I can show it to you. I'm used to. Maybe next time. But the history of the Whig Party, of the American Whig Party. No one was more devoted to bringing back the National Bank than Abe Lincoln. And so this is a long history in American history about the bank, the central bank. The first central bank was the Bank of North America. It only lasted about a year because it debased its currency so much. And then immediately the nationalists in American politics, the people who wanted an empire that would rival the British Empire, these were the Hamiltonians or the Federalists, they began lobbying for another national bank, which they succeeded in getting, called the First Bank of the United States. The First Bank of the United States had a 20-year charter beginning in 1791, rather, and it was not renewed after 20 years because it created boom and bust cycles and it corrupted politics. But then the War of 1812 was an excuse that was used to resurrect it, and then Andrew Jackson vetoed the rechartering of it in the early 1830s. And so the Bank of the United States was defunct, and there was a lot of help. Andrew Jackson had a lot of help from politicians in the states, especially states like Maryland and Ohio. But he did win the bank war, and he did decimate the Bank of the United States. That was in the 1830s, just when Abe Lincoln entered politics. So all throughout his career, he was in favor of a national banking system and the suspension of specie payment. That is, the suspension of the requirement that paper money issued by banks be redeemable in gold or silver. And one story about this that is told in David Donald's biography of Abe Lincoln, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, David Donald, is how when Lincoln was in the Illinois state legislature, there was a law that was passed that said that at the end of the year, once January 1st came along, the money currency issued by Illinois state banks would once again become redeemable in gold and silver. And Lincoln was the leader of the Whig Party at this time. This was in the mid to late 1830s. He was the leader of the Whig Party. And so they did everything they could to not have this law go into effect. And so they wanted to try to stop the Illinois legislature from adjourning and going home for Christmas at the end of the year by fleeing the room in which the legislature was meeting so that they would not have a quorum. They would not have enough politicians. So all of the Whigs sought to leave. But the door was blocked. The Democratic Party in Illinois had made sure that security guards would block the door and they couldn't get out. So Abe Lincoln literally jumped out of a second story window and his fellow Whigs followed him. And after which the Democrats sort of mocked and ridiculed Abe Lincoln by calling him Leaping Lincoln and his flying brethren. And that's sort of an example of the extremes to which Lincoln went in politics to destroy sound money. And so there was a very long battle over the bringing the bank back. And this battle started with Alexander Hamilton, who was essentially the political water carrier for the Northeastern business and banking interests. And so by the time you get to the early 1840s, there was no more national bank. There was something called the sub-treasury system, and I don't want to get into that in a lot of detail, but a number of highly respected economists, such as Richard Timberlake, who retired from teaching at the University of Georgia for many years, he wrote a big treatise on the history of monetary policy in the United States, said that this period from the 1840s to the 1860s, while not perfect, was probably the most stable monetary system America has ever had. Jeffrey Hummel says the same thing in his writings on monetary history, and he also mentions this in his book, Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men, his book on the American Civil War. And so there are some pretty good libertarian monetary theorists who have said that this wasn't a perfect system. No system is, no monetary system is, but it was probably the most stable system ever in the history of the United States. And that was all changed, though, during the Lincoln administration. Once the Southern Democrats left, once they left Congress, well, then they gave up any right to bring slaves into the territories, of course, for one thing. So that became a moot issue. But also, the Republicans understood that they could finally ram through the old Hamiltonian American system, which they did. And one of the first items of business was the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts that created the greenback dollar. And they promptly inflated the greenback dollar so that it was worth one half of its value within 1 year during the war. They also imposed a special tax on competing currencies in an attempt to drive them out of the market. And so the money supply was nationalized. There was not a new bank. They did not create or resurrect the Bank of the United States or any version of it. But it did go a long way toward nationalizing the money supply in America. And this was a very major stepping stone along the way to the creation of the Fed many years later in 1913. And so we had a much more highly regulated by the federal government monetary system put into place, cemented into place during the Lincoln administration. And so Lincoln did achieve that. When he said in 1832 that one of his goals was a national bank, didn't quite get a national bank, but he did get the nationalization of money in his time. Now the second big issue, of which there is a long story to be told, and I can't go into all the detail about this long story, was protectionism, the battle over protectionism. As I said, Lincoln said the reason he got into politics was that his politics were short and sweet. And what did he want to do that was so short and sweet? He wanted to do those three things: protectionism, corporate welfare, and a national bank. And here's one more statement by yet another historian, David Donald, on what happened during the Lincoln administration. David Donald is sort of spouting the traditional sort of left-wing historian line on Lincoln's domestic policies. He's wrote an article in the Smithsonian Magazine in October of 2004, David Donald did. It's called The Road Not Taken. And it's an article about, well, what would have happened had Abe Lincoln not been elected president, had someone else been elected president? And he says, well, all of this domestic legislation would not have been passed. And David Donald thinks this is a bad thing, but I think it's a good thing. It would have been a good thing had this not been passed. Here's what he says. Well, the Democratic majority in Congress would have blocked the important economic and social legislation enacted by the Republicans during the Civil War. Thus, there would likely have been no high tariff laws that protected the iron industry, so essential in post-war economic development. No Homestead Act, giving 160 acres to settlers willing to occupy until land out west. No transcontinental railroad legislation. No land grant colleges. No currency or national banking system. No Department of Agriculture. What a horror. Without such legislation, the economic takeoff that made the United States a major industrial power by the end of the century would have been prevented. This, of course, is all hogwash and baloney, because all of these things were just mercantilist, crony capitalist schemes. And the American economy took off despite the fact that all these crony capitalist schemes were put into place. Such as high protective tariffs, for example. International trade was less than 10% of the U.S. economy anyway. So the high protectionist tariffs were a bad thing in many ways. But to put it in perspective, they only affected less than 10% of the whole U.S. economy. And so the second plank, though, of Lincoln's economic platform, protectionism, there almost was a civil war in 1828 when the state of South Carolina nullified what was called the Tariff of Abominations, when the Whig Party, it wasn't quite the Whig Party yet, but it was the people who had formed the Whig Party, led by Henry Clay, who got the Tariff of Abominations passed through Congress that raised the average tariff rate up to almost 45%. Today, for example, by comparison, it's around 2%. And so if this was nullified by South Carolina, they refused to collect the tax. They even voted to give the governor $160,000 in 1828 to be used to purchase firearms to fend off federal tax collectors should they come down to South Carolina to try to collect the tariff tax. So they were serious, and it led to a confrontation with President Andrew Jackson at the time, and they ended up negotiating a settlement. Both sides backed down. Both sides backed away. And so they ended up, over the succeeding 10 years, beginning in 1832, reducing the tariff rate down to a more competitive level, so that by the time you get to 1857, the average tariff rate was back down to 15%. That's 15%. So there almost was a war then. Then Lincoln, and as a Whig, was a lifelong protectionist. There was an article written about this, an old article written about Lincoln's lifelong infatuation with protectionist tariffs as a Whig politician by a man named Reinhard Rupin. As a historian, they wrote this way back in the 1940s. Reinhard H. Rupin, it's in the American Historical Review in July 1944, and it's an account of how Lincoln got the nomination, the Republican Party nomination. And among his supporters were the editors and owners of the Chicago Press and Tribune, the Chicago newspaper. Especially a man named Joseph Middle, spelled M-E-D-I-L-L, who was the publisher. And so what Lincoln did was he wrote letters to all, he figured out that he needed New York and Pennsylvania delegations to win the nomination, especially Pennsylvania. So he focused his efforts on Pennsylvania. And he wrote all of the top Republicans in Pennsylvania, Thaddeus Stevens, Simon Cameron, and many others at the time, to assure them that he was as big a protectionist as they would find anywhere. Here's a letter that Lincoln wrote to a man named Dr. Edward Wallace, who was a big shot in the Pennsylvania Republican Party at the time. So, "My dear sir, your brother, Dr. William Wallace, showed me a letter of yours in which you kindly mention my name, inquire about my tariff view, and suggest the propriety of my writing a letter upon the subject. I was an old Henry Clay tariff Whig. In old times, I made more speeches on that subject than any other, and I have not changed my views." End quote. That was Abe Lincoln. And he wrote letters like this to all the top Republicans. And then he sent an emissary, Judge David Davis, who he would later appoint to the Supreme Court. He sent him with original copies of all of his speeches in favor of higher tariffs to show them to all the top Republicans to guarantee them that he would be in favor of high protectionist tariffs on steel. This is Pennsylvania, after all, steel, which was a steel manufacturing senate. And he said this to Judge Davis, "Nothing about these speeches must get into the newspapers." So what Lincoln was doing here is he understood that farmers especially were in favor of free trade and against high protectionist tariffs, because high protectionist tariffs not only forced them to pay more for the clothing that they bought and the farm tools and farm machinery, but also, since it impoverished American trading partners in Europe especially, these trading partners then had fewer dollars with which to buy American goods, primarily agricultural goods. And so farmers were hurt in terms of their business being hurt. So Lincoln, who was a very clever politician, did this all in secret because he did not want to lose votes among farmers, if they found out that he was going to raise tariffs. But he wanted the votes by the protectionists in Pennsylvania and elsewhere by secretly guaranteeing to them that he was, in fact, a protectionist. And so he did that. And in this article, when Lincoln finally was voted in, Bernard Luther writes this: the Pennsylvania and New Jersey delegations at the Republican convention were terrific in their applause over the tariff resolution, and their hilarity was contagious, finally pervading the whole vast auditorium. And so, and when Lincoln made it home, back home to Springfield, Illinois, after winning the nomination, there was a gigantic sign that, read what would become his campaign slogan. It was on one of the official campaign posters: protection for home industry, protection for home industry. And so once he was elected, of course, you know, I already said last week, in light of this, he owed everything politically to the protectionists in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, and elsewhere. And so in his first inaugural address, of course, he threatens war over tariff collection. But even before that, in a February 19, 1861 speech in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, this was several weeks before he was inaugurated, he made a speech in which he told his audience that no other issue, nothing was more important than raising the tariff. Now, this, of course, would have made him very popular in Pennsylvania, where they were manufacturing steel. But at the time, the moral tariff had not passed the Senate. It passed the Senate 2 days before Lincoln was inaugurated. So he was out there campaigning before he was inaugurated, but after he was elected, for the moral tariff. And it was signed into law. And Bernard Luther wrote this: Morrill, John Sherman of Ohio, and Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania steered the bill, the tariff bill, through the House. Simon Cameron of Pennsylvania and James F. Simmons of Rhode Island, a wealthy textile mill owner, guided it through the Senate. And so Lincoln did owe everything to the tariff protectionists. And during his administration, he signed 10 tariff increasing bills. And so, and to put this into perspective a little more, the moral tariff passed the House of Representatives during the 1859-1860 legislative session. This was before any Southern state seceded, before Lincoln was elected, before he was even nominated. So this was the policy of the Republican Party. It wasn't just a war financing measure. And that tariff rate, of course, when Lincoln got in, the moral tariff increased the average tariff rate from 15% to 32.7%, and then it eventually made it up to close to 50%, and it remained that in that range for the average tariff rate for the next 50 years, until the income tax came into being. And so this was the policy of the Republican Party, and it was the policy of Abe Lincoln. And I think you can make a very strong case that it was a very important part of why he was elected. Now, another thing that these historians say, and when they quote Senator John Sherman as saying, why Lincoln was elected, or you quote Lincoln himself talking about internal improvements, well, railroad subsidies. They're talking about railroad subsidies primarily at this time. Lincoln spent 25 years as a Whig lobbying for corporate welfare for road and canal building companies. When he was the leader of the Whigs in the Illinois State Legislature, he was as responsible as anyone for getting the legislature to allocate some $11 million for road and canal building projects across the state. He said he wanted Illinois to become the Empire State of the Midwest, rivaling New York State. And it turned out, though, that nothing was finished. Nothing. Not one road, not one canal was actually finished. Much of the money was stolen. There was a recession in 1837. And so it was a huge calamity. The taxpayers of Illinois were left with huge tax bills to pay off this debt for many years to come, and they got nothing for it. And Lincoln was the leader of that, and he never gave up on that, regardless of how disastrous it was. In fact, state after state did similar things, and it was so disastrous at the state level, the use of tax dollars for road and canal building, that by the time you get to the 1860s, only one state, Massachusetts, had not amended its constitution to prohibit the use of tax dollars going to any corporation for any reason, because it had been such a debacle in state after state after state. But it was a debacle for the taxpayers, but it was great for the crony capitalists who got the money, and who pocketed the money, who stole the money, who made money for building shoddy roads and unfinished canals. And it was also a great thing for the politicians who plundered the taxpayers of their state and handed over all this money, all these millions of dollars, to their politically connected business friends, who of course in turn helped finance their political careers. That was the system. So to Lincoln and the Republicans, this was all great. It was a financial calamity to the taxpayers, but so what? It helped strengthen their political party. And so Lincoln never did say, oh my goodness, maybe we should rethink this and step back from this impulse to use tax dollars to build roads, canals, and railroads. Quite the contrary, when he became president, not only did he owe the protectionists in the steel industry and other manufacturing industries just about everything, he also owed the railroad corporations an awful lot because they sponsored his political career as well. Lincoln was one of the biggest, most famous, wealthiest railroad lawyers in America during his time. There's a book by John W. Starr, spelled S-T-A-R-R, of Lincoln and the Railroads that I would recommend if anyone is interested in this. And here's what John Starr says. Mr. Lincoln was continuously one of the attorneys for the Illinois Central Railroad Company from its organization in 1849 until he was elected president. In addition to representing the Illinois Central, Lincoln also represented the Chicago and Alton, Ohio and Mississippi, and Rock Island Railroads. As soon as the Chicago and Mississippi Railroad was built, he was appointed a local attorney for that corporation. By 1860, he was probably the most sought-after attorney in the entire railroad industry in America. And he was also offered a job as general counsel of the New York Central Railroad by Erastus Corning. And he turned down the job. He didn't take the job, even though it was offered to pay him $10,000, which was more than three times what the governor of Illinois was paid at that time. And so, but he had other fish to fry. And so Lincoln, the railroad lawyer, traveled around the Midwest in a private rail car, courtesy of the Illinois Central, with an entourage of Illinois Central executives. And he wore very expensive suits, and he was sort of the man who the younger executive, the younger people in business sort of looked up to as, I want to be wealthy and part of the business elite like that. So he was a wealthy corporate business, corporate elitist at the time he was elected president, just like just about every other American president that you can think of in all of American history. And so when he became president, the war, of course, started in the spring of 1861. And in April of 1861, with the war, Fort Sumter barely over with, and with the first major battle of the Civil War, the Battle of First Manassas, impending, what does Abe Lincoln do? He calls for a special session of Congress to meet in June, same month of the Battle of First Manassas, and to talk about what? To talk about building a government-subsidized railroad line to California. So there's a war that is about to commence. They're trying to raise taxes every way possible. They're establishing an internal revenue bureaucracy for the first time. They're talking about instituting an income tax for the first time in American history. And what are they talking about doing with regard to spending the money? Starting building a railroad in Iowa across the Rocky Mountains to California. Lincoln signed the Pacific Railway Bill about a year later, and in that bill it gave the president the right to determine the eastern terminus where the railroad would start building. He chose Council Bluffs, Iowa, and it's not a coincidence, I don't believe, that in 1857 Abe Lincoln had invested in a huge plot of land in Council Bluffs, Iowa, so he must have made a killing on this real estate investment of his, and I think it probably explains why in that year he turned down the job offer from Erastus Corning to become the lawyer for the New York Central Railroad. And so, and this has been, and so when he signed this bill, it made millionaires of quite a few Republican politicians. Dee Brown was the historian of the American West, the late Dee Brown. He wrote a famous book about Wounded Knee. I left my heart at Wounded Knee, about the Indians. And he also wrote a very well-known book called Hear That Lonesome Whistle Blow, about the building of the government-subsidized Transcontinental Railroad. And he said, when Lincoln signed this bill, the Pacific Railway Bill, quote, he assured the fortunes of a dynasty of American families, the Brewsters, Bushnells, Olcotts, Parkers, Harrisons, Trowbridges, Landworthies, Reeds, Ogdens, Bradfords, Noises, Brooks, Cornells, and dozens of others. He goes on to say, Thaddeus Stevens received a block of Union Pacific stock in exchange for his vote in Congress for subsidies. He also demanded, did Stevens, as a condition of his yes vote, insertion of a clause in the law requiring that all iron used in the construction and equipment of said railroad to be American manufactured. Patty Stevens was an iron manufacturer from Pennsylvania. Republican Congressman Oakes Ames, who with his brother Oliver manufactured shovels in Massachusetts, became a loyal ally of the Union Pacific Railroad and helped to pressure the 1864 Pacific Railway Act through the war-corrupted Congress, D. Brown writes, because of course it must have taken a lot of shovels to dig railroad beds from Iowa to California. And he was a shovel manufacturer, so he made quite the killing too. And so you have all the leading lights of the Republican Party making a lot of money on the Pacific Railway bill. So when Senator John Sherman said, Lincoln is our man, we elected him to get the ways of communication from the Atlantic to the Pacific, he meant a government-subsidized railroad. Now, some 10 years later, James J. Hill built the Great Northern Railroad with no government subsidy, no land grants at all. It was all private capital. He paid for rights of way across Indian land with cash, cattle, or whatever they could trade for. And so he proved that the government subsidies were not necessary to build transcontinental railroads. Something that had been debated for decades, like the tariff issue, that had been debated for decades with Lincoln and his Republican cohorts finally putting into place institutionalized corporate welfare in the form of the massive subsidies for the railroad corporations. And once that happened, then there was a flood of lobbyists that descended on Congress asking for their subsidies for just about anything imaginable after that. And so so the constitutional constraints that once existed on tax dollars going to private corporations were obliterated and really no longer existed. There's even one of the books about this that I cite in my Lincoln books about this period of history is called The Era of Good Stealings. You might recall from reading of history somewhere that there was an era of good feelings. And this book is The Era of Good Stealings. And it's just the perfect title for a book of that sort. And so in terms of Lincoln, the Hamiltonian mercantilist, all of these things really were debated in American politics from the time of the American founding, when Hamilton and the Federalist Party wanted to bring to America British mercantilism. The Jeffersonians opposed it by making the argument that we just fought a revolution to get away from this wicked system. Why would we want to have it here? And so you went up and down. You had the Tariff of Abominations, and then that was nullified by South Carolina, and the tariff rate was reduced to 15% by 1857. You had the First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States finally snuffed out by Andrew Jackson. And you had the awful record of internal improvement subsidies at the state government level that was a financial disaster everywhere, So none of the elements of the American system, which were the reason for existence of the American Whig Party, was successful prior to the 1860s. But the Republican Party very swiftly and expertly took advantage of the fact that the chief opponents were always Southern Democrats. Chief opponents were always mostly Southern Democrats. Although there were Southern politicians who were mercantilists, who were Hamiltonians, and there were Northern politicians who were Jeffersonians. But the majority of the opposition, if you look at all the presidents who vetoed all these things, Jefferson, Madison, all the way up through James Buchanan of Pennsylvania, most of them were Southerners who vetoed all of these. James Monroe, John Tyler, they were all against these things. Andrew Jackson on the bank. Andrew Jackson from Tennessee. But with these people all gone, with secession, the Republicans had their way, and they finally cemented into place Hamiltonian mercantilism, and which still haunts us to this day. Corporate bailouts, central banking, protectionism as a form of central banking, massive government giveaways. In those days, it was land. Today, it's welfare. It's just cash and in-kind benefits for welfare. But there was no welfare state in the 1860s apart from the Homestead Act. But the Homestead Act, like I said, most of the land did go to corporations because, after all, the Republican Party was the party of corporations. It was the party of crony capitalism then as it is today. And that's why they chose Abraham Lincoln as their president. As Senator John Sherman said, as the historian Michael Holt said, as all these other people that I quoted said, historians and politicians of the day, this is why Lincoln was their man. It's not because he promised a war to end slavery. No one in the North wanted to end Southern slavery except for the small number of people who were abolitionists. And the abolition societies never claimed more than 2% of the adult male population as members. There were certainly very few of any people who were of importance in national politics from the North were in favor of this. They did not put this in their platform. The Republican Party platform had the protection of Southern slavery in its platform. It opposed the extension of slavery for white supremacist and political reasons, but at the same time, it endorsed Southern slavery. But at the same time, of course, it endorsed all these economic projects, protectionism, et cetera. And so I think that's about what I'll say for tonight in terms of Lincoln, the Hamiltonian mercantilist. I call this Lincoln's real agenda in my book, The Real Lincoln. And I think it's the one thing that has infuriated the history profession, which, of course, if you're trained as a historian, you don't know anything necessarily about economics. And so you don't know how to analyze these things, even if you tried, for the most part. And so they tend to sweep it under the rug, ignore it, and tell all sorts of tall tales that don't seem to have a lot to do with the real Lincoln. And I guess that's all I'll say for now for tonight. And we'll do what we usually do, and I'll look at the chat here and see if we have any questions, and I'll try to answer them. I see Cam has been doing his typical great job with all the links. Larry Simon says, no big tariff, no war. If you look at, Lincoln stated very clearly that he went to war over the tariff, that he would go over the war over the tariff in his first inaugural address. But if you also read Jefferson Davis's first inaugural address, it was all about tariff. It wasn't about slavery at all, his first inaugural address. I'm just going to find it quickly, or probably not too quickly, get exactly where this is in this book. But if you look it up online, Jefferson Davis's first inaugural address delivered in Montgomery, Alabama, He says, we are an agricultural nation that trades with all the world, and we don't want to fight to maintain that right, but we will if we have to. That is essentially the gist of a large part of Jefferson Davis' personal address. So you have the president of the Confederacy saying the tariff is a big issue, maybe the biggest, and the Northerners are threatening us with this because they want to impose a high protectionist tariff. If we don't, we have seceded over this and over other issues, and if they try to force us to come back in the Union so that they can tax us at a much higher rate, we will fight. And then you have Lincoln, before he takes office, telling people in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that there is no other issue, nothing in the world is more important than raising the tariff. And so there you have it. The two presidents in their first inaugural addresses focused in a very, very big way on the tariff issue. And the history profession claims that the tariff had nothing whatsoever to do with the war. But Abe Lincoln would disagree with them, and so would Jefferson Davis if they were alive today. Yeah, a lot of great work by Cam, as always. I can't believe he's so fast in getting these links. Okay, William is asking, well, I call the Homestead Act a form of welfare. Well, it is giving people something for nothing. It certainly was a form of corporate welfare because the massive land was given to railroad corporations. And they ended up selling a lot of it and just pocketing the money to mining corporations and timber corporations. And so, so if you had to work the land, that's sort of like an analogy to today would be requiring people on welfare to work 10 hours a week. I think I would still call it a form of a government handout. South Main exports cotton, tobacco, rice, soybeans. I don't think alcohol was too heavy to transport overseas, but certainly cotton was the overwhelming product that was exported, not only to Europe but to the New England textile factories as well. Travis is asking how the right-wing conservative Republicans sell themselves as the free market party. Well, I don't think anyone who pays attention can think of the Republican Party as a free market party. They become the champions of corporate welfare. They've returned to their Lincolnian roots, to be sure. So the Republican Party of today, the party of George W. Bush and the Wall Street bailouts and the Fed bailouts and crony capitalism and the party of crony capitalism really is exactly the same as the party of Lincoln during Lincoln's time. Only the industries are different. It's very much Wall Street centered today. And if you're in the mood for reading a 730-page book about this, read David Stockman's new book, The Great Transformation. It's all about this. Democrats and Republicans, but mostly Republicans. So I don't see how they could get some of them who still use this language. I guess they just don't understand the history of their own party. Now, I would say Malcolm is asking, well, the real beginning of the welfare state came, most historians say came with the pensions to Civil War veterans. That was sort of the beginnings of the American welfare state, because anybody who ever wore a uniform for a day got one. In the North, anyway, no pensions were given to Confederate veterans, but anyone like Lincoln's son, Todd Lincoln, he was of military age. He was 18 years old in 1861, and he spent the war fighting for dates at Harvard with pretty girls at Harvard University. So he spent the whole war at Harvard University, in the last couple of months of the war, Lincoln put him on General Grant's staff, far away from the danger, just so he could call himself a Civil War veteran. And so there were a lot of people like that, like in all armies and all wars, that didn't really see combat, but they nevertheless got the lifelong pension from the U.S. taxpayer. So yeah, the Great Deformation. I don't know if I called it transformation. It is a great book. I just finished it, and I'm writing a long review essay of it for the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. And I think of it as a financial markets human action. It's as dense as Human Action by Ludwig von Mises, but it's centered mostly on financial markets. And that's one area where the Austrian economists have not really written a lot, financial markets. And so this book is a treasure trove of information on Austrian economists who want to learn more or research more on financial markets and the role of government in corrupting financial markets and transforming them from free market institutions or capitalistic institutions to crony capitalist institutions. There's a question, do I know anything about the rules on Negro cloth? I don't. So the question says, he heard a lecture about this, that they use worse cloth for the Negro clothing. Well, I don't know about that, but I do know there's a book called Time on the Cross, The Economics of American Negro Slavery by Robert Fogel and Steve Ingerman. Fogel won the Nobel Prize in Economics. He was an economic historian. And Fogel took a lot of criticism for this book because he documented the sort of a common sense idea that these slave owners purchased slaves for thousands of dollars. And so it wouldn't make sense, it wouldn't be rational to spend all that money. So that's just the purchase price. And then you had to feed, clothe, and house them. Then to make them disabled by beating them and abusing them and so forth. And so he was suspicious of this standard story of how brutalized the slaves were. And some obviously were. Some, they were whipped, beaten, abused, they were slaves. But as an economist, he was thinking, well, it doesn't really sound right. Well, why would these people who themselves looked at slaves as an asset, as a business asset, destroy the asset? And so if you're interested in this question, I don't know anything about this cloth that the clothes were made of for the slaves. But that's one of the themes of the book Time on the Cross by Fogel and Ingerman is that American slavery wasn't quite as brutal as the movies have made it out to be, because it wouldn't have made economic sense for people to do that. Although, of course, there was a lot of brutality. I mean, by the nature of the system, it of course invited abuse. And human beings, being what they are, some are going to be abusive, and others are not. The question from Malcolm Sherman said Sherman said that the purpose was to give the land to actual settlers. Well, I can guess. My guess is that a lot of people were suspicious that the Republican Party was going to give the land away to railroad corporations, and he was saying, "Oh no, settlers, people like you," and so the public could go along with this. But then, of course, once they're in power and they have the ability to give away the land, they gave most of it away to the railroad corporations. And so that's my guess of what he's saying there. He's lying, in other words. Lincoln, Adam is asking, Lincoln was a teetotaler. He didn't drink. But he was infatuated with firearms. He experimented. He had the military experimenting day in and day out in bigger and bigger weapons of mass destruction to be used by his fellow citizens in the southern states. If you ever saw any pictures of some of these Civil War cannons, they're these gigantic things that had to be carried about on railroad cars. They were so big and heavy, and they would lob bombs the size of a small automobile 2 miles into the city of Charleston, things like that. And so he certainly was not opposed to that type of weaponry. In terms of against firearms, Adam is asked about removal. While they did confiscate firearms, the government did in the border states, you know, in opposition to the Second Amendment of the Constitution. So there was a massive confiscation of firearms in the border states where the U.S. Army occupied those states during the Civil War, states like Maryland, for example. The rail guns, I guess Cam knows that they were called rail guns. Let's see if there's anything under the Q&A area here. No. And Travis is asking, is it true that the central bank, the Fed, I guess, is really a private bank? The Fed has stockholders, banks, or shareholders, but of course the chairman is appointed by the president, as are the heads of all the other Fed banks, are political appointees. And so so the president and Congress has a hand in appointing who the chairman is. So the Fed is a political animal, a political institution, although it is partly owned by stockholders. And so it's the ultimate crony capitalist scheme, in other words. So, but it's not a private institution. It's a government-controlled institution because the president appoints the chairman and can reappoint or fire the chairman. And the chairman will do, in general, what the president, who can appoint him, wants him to do. Let's see, there's a question, why was the giving of land away an impetus keeping tariffs high? Well, the Southerners wanted to sell off the land rather than give it away, because then they could make the case for reducing the tariff rate, and the government would not lose revenue. It was a revenue neutrality argument. If the government was taking in, say, $1 billion a year in those days, and say the average tariff rate was 40%, and this disproportionately harmed Southerners because they were an agricultural society, for the reason I gave earlier. And so if they did that, and they made, say, $100 million in land sales, then the Southerners thought they could go to Congress and make the case for reducing the average tariff rate maybe to 20 or 25% instead of 40%, and the government would still take in $1 billion. It wouldn't lose money. That was their argument, that they should replace some of the revenue that was taken in by a too high tariff rate with money taken in by the sale of public lands. Let's see, what's the name of my book on Lincoln? Well, we try to make these courses online, everything online. My two books are The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked. And the subtitle of The Real Lincoln is A New Look at Abraham Lincoln, His Agenda, and an Unnecessary War. And the subtitle of Lincoln Unmasked is What You're Not Supposed to Know About Dishonest Abe. And the modus operandi of the Meet Academy is online education. Although the next course I'm going to teach is on the famous book, The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich Hayek. And I'm probably going to start that the first week of July, I think. And we do have students buy the book because it's not online. And but I didn't ask anybody to buy my book because I've written so many articles on the web. I thought there's enough there that we can make this an online course, and you don't have to spend any more money. And but if, of course, if you want to, by all means, go out and buy my books and buy them for all your friends and family. And my books are both published by a division of Random House, so they're available wherever books are sold, including Amazon.com. The Real Lincoln was number two in sales on Amazon.com a few months after it came out in 2002. It was the day after Walter Williams interviewed me on the Rush Limbaugh radio show for a whole hour about the book. It went to number two in sales the next day on Amazon. Another question about of Malcolm. He doesn't know any other century where slavery, the ending of slavery, was associated with the violence of war. There were slave revolts. There was a slave revolt in Haiti. My reading of history also tells me that there were some genuine civil wars in Central America in the 19th century where there were slaves. And in some of the countries, the slaves were told, if you fight on our side, we will give you your freedom once we take over the government. But it was not a war to end slavery. Ending slavery had nothing whatsoever to do, because these were genuine civil wars, which are wars to take over the central government. But the American Civil War, which is a big misnomer, by the way, was not a civil war in that sense, because Jefferson Davis did not want to run the government in Washington any more than George Washington fought the American Revolution so he could run the government in London, England. And so I do know about these Central American civil wars. They were not wars about ending slavery. They involved slaves to some degree, but they were not about that. And Lincoln Uncensored is a Kindle book that is very good. I have to get around to reviewing it on LouRockwell.com. It's all about Lincoln's original sources, the original speeches, and contrasting that with what the historians say Lincoln was about. And his own words show in chapter after chapter that what he was about, in his own words, was very different from what the historians tell you he was about. Let's see, any more questions here? Bob is asking about Lincoln's fragment on the Constitution and the Union. I'm not sure what Bob means there. The fragment on the Constitution and the Union. I don't know what that means, I'm afraid. The Lincoln Uncensored is published by Laissez-Faire Books. It's one of Jeff Tupper's projects. And so I really do need to get around to reviewing it. I promised the author that I would review it on LouRockwell.com, but I haven't done it yet. It looks like we're sort of running out of gas again. Okay, well, Malcolm is talking about this debate that I had with Gerald Rakupowicz. If you want to read it, it was published on the North and South magazine. I guess it's online by now. If you can look for North and South magazine, well, it's online. It was several years ago, 5 or 6 years ago now, that I had this debate. Bob says, I'm not sure what you mean, the fragment on the Constitution and the Union. What are you referring to? What fragments? I know a lot about what Lincoln said and did about the Constitution. That's the topic of next week. Larry is asking, how did the Republican Party get to be known as the party of small government? Well, it never was. It was the party of big government all during the 19th century. The Democrats were the party of small government. Then the Democrats were taken over by the progressives in the late part of the century, early 20th century, and they became the party of socialism and interventionism from then on. And the Republican Party always was the party of militarism and corporate welfare. And it became known as the party of small government only because of Ronald Reagan's rhetoric 30 years ago. Not his reality for the most part, but his rhetoric. They were the only really good Republican presidents were, you know, Harding was not too bad because they didn't do much of anything. And so the 1920s was sort of the high watermark of Republican Party presidents because they didn't do much. But then they elected Hoover. When Hoover became president in 1928, he was an interventionist, he was a progressive, and a disaster. He established the prototype for FDR's New Deal. And so there's no reason to believe the Republican Party was ever a party of free markets, other than a very short, maybe 2-year period, the first 2 years of the Reagan administration, where he did have some very good appointees that did some decent things, such as helping along with the deregulation of trucking and airlines, and the antitrust deregulation, and he did deregulate the oil industry faster than what Jimmy Carter wanted to do, but that's about it. Ron Paul is a Republican because he seriously wanted to get elected president, and he seriously wanted to be at a national stage and espouse his views, which he would not have had he been a libertarian, because most people, I think, correctly think of the Libertarian Party as a gang of kooks. they booed and smeared Murray Rothbard, who had more knowledge on his little, on the tip of his little finger than all of the rest of them combined, for example. Chatting is going here. Well, it looks like we're running out of gas. So maybe we'll end it for tonight. It's about 7:15, and thanks again for participating. And next week we're going to talk about Lincoln's trashing and evisceration of the United States Constitution. And so you can forward this along to the people at Hillsdale, and maybe that would give them some heartburn, since some Bob has been talking about them. So have a good night, and thanks a lot for participating.